Been thinking about a vacation trip to the Pacific Northwest? Well, those are just a few of the sounds of this big country. We think sounds are about the best way of communicating there is. So we've assembled a collection of typical sounds of the Pacific Northwest. Now sit back and listen.
It's the Lifers Podcast with Scott Lucas, Gabe Rodriguez, and Ben Reiser. And now, here's Scott, Gabe, and Ben.
Guys, how's it going? I've been out of town for the past week or so. Not out of town, I've been out of the country for the past week or so.
Yeah.
What have I missed?
Gabe's been texting me about the Taylor Swift album that came out while you were gone.
Are you serious?
And the Donald Trump trial, which started while you were gone.
That's big news, both of them. But we don't talk about big news on the show.
But should it be big news? I got back into the country, and people, news is talking about whether or not Donald Trump is farting in court.
How is that even a question?
That's the biggest story all week. Wait till Saturday Night Live next week.
Oh, my God. Gabe, who do we have on the show today?
You're asking me who we got on the show today. Scott McCuffey. McCoy. How do you say it?
What? It's McCoy. How do you think you say it?
When you look at it, it looks like McCuffey.
It looks like it's spelled wrong, right? Or it looks like it's pronounced wrong. It's McCoy.
Yes, he's... I would call him a road dog. Something like that. He's been around a long time.
He plays with a bunch of different bands.
Yes.
First, the Young Fresh Fellows. Minus Five. He played with REM for a while. Robin Hitchcock.
A road dog.
Hold on. Okay. He plays with the Baseball Project. Tons of bands. Some that we're leaving out. It's insane.
Can I now ask my question about?
I think so. Yes.
So you say road dog, that implies to me more of like a touring musician. But Scott McCoy has been recording as much as touring all these years. He's a recording artist with Peter Buck and with his own bands that he fronts and with all kinds of side projects that he's either
solo records.
So
many records and so many record projects where like he'll make records that are a part of a series of records. You're right, Ben. It would be reductive to call the man a road dog.
You could do like
Gabe is nothing if not a reductive.
Okay. Not every musician is a road
reductive
dog.
Reductive producer.
Every road dog is a musician, something like that.
You're a road dog. You're not a musician.
Well, no, good I'm not. Point. Well, no. Well, then don't.
Okay,
don't.
He's a performing road dog, but not a session player. Yeah, whatever. He's our guest.
He's done sessions. Yeah. The guy has
a resume.
He's got a resume, right?
You know,
around here, that's the best thing you can say about anybody.
You could do a 6 degrees of Scott McCoy thing, just like you do with Kevin Bacon, and I think you could go a long way in that game.
It would be sick. I was hanging out the other night at this bar. This guy's trying to insert himself into our conversation. And he goes, well, I know you from 4-H. I go, huh? He goes, from playing in 4-H. I go, oh, yeah, that's how you know me? He goes, yeah, I just know that's what you do. I'm like, 4-H club? What are you talking about? So I busted a bottle over his head.
I believe it.
Can we do a Gabe Rodriguez's TV corner?
Back in Gabe Rodriguez days, TV was a hit parade. Everybody had it made. Those were the Gabes.
Gabe Rodriguez's TV corner.
Was I prepared for this? Or are you going to put me on the spot?
So, Gabe, do you remember the Brady Bunch episode where they perform a play and it's the Seven Dwarves?
I don't remember the Seven Dwarves. Do I remember?
Ben, do you remember this?
No, is this a Cousin Oliver episode?
No, but it is when Sam was hanging around a lot, when Alice's boyfriend Sam was hanging around. And he plays... I don't know who he's supposed to play.
And now, we'd like to give you our version of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Mirror, mirror that I see, is there anyone fairer than me? And you know what your answer had better be.
Snow White?
I just remembered I forgot something. I'll be back later.
Oh, no. Oh, your wickedness, don't leave me alone. I'm afraid.
Eat this while I'm gone. It will calm you down.
Would you stop doing that, Dopey?
It's horrifying. It's a horrifying episode. They were playing it at the airport.
How many seasons were there of the Brady Bunch? There wasn't that many.
Oh, no?
I beg to differ.
I don't think it went on that long.
They used to try to make sure they did at least seven seasons so they could syndicate. And if anything was syndicated, it was the Brady Bunch, so.
I know you remember this one, is the Joe Namath episode, where Bobby pretends that he's dying so Joe Namath will come visit him.
How do you remember these things? I could go the rest of my life without remembering these things.
How do you not remember this? Okay, this is going to blow your friggin' mind. Are you ready?
Go ahead.
The Brady Bunch lasted for blank seasons. Gabe.
Six. No, it'd be more. It'd be seven.
Ben.
I'm going to say eight.
Five seasons.
That's
I told you it wasn't that many.
But excuse me, but in those days, how many episodes were there per season? At least 25, probably 30, maybe 40.
I think like 24. There were 24 episodes per season when Seinfeld was going on.
But this is pre-Seinfeld. They were cutting down by the time Seinfeld hit.
Maybe, but it doesn't really matter, does it?
Well, because five seasons, back in those days is like 10 seasons now.
Season one, I've got an episode guide, okay? I'm going to look it up.
Yeah.
25 episodes.
Okay.
Now let's see what happens when we get to season four. How many episodes are we looking at?
23.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not a lot.
Well.
No, it didn't last that long.
That's 125 episodes. That's not bad.
So season five starts with Adios, Johnny Bravo. So in 73, they do the Johnny Bravo episode. And that's your favorite, right, Gabe?
Yes, because he fit the suit.
Remember there was a Brady Bunch dramatic, like, hour-long show at some point? And, of course, there was the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, which was totally insane. Like a Sid and Marty Krofft
thing.
A total
of 22 episodes were aired in 73, with the series finale episode, Harebrained Scheme, airing on March 8, 1974. So at what point are we looking at Oliver?
I'm hoping he was only there for that final season.
Okay, so here's this episode. Snow White and the Seven Bradys that I was talking about. At Cindy's behest, the family and Sam put on a backyard theater production of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. When it is discovered Alice has already eaten the poison apple while rehearsing, Sam and Mike rush to the store in costume to buy an apple. Sam receives a parking fine, and the policeman says they must have a permit to host the production. A permit is granted on short notice, allowing the show to go on. Wow, how's that for drama, guys?
It's pretty intense.
Why did that show end, by the way? Did anybody know?
Probably because of episodes like that. So was Oliver there for a while and then he fucked off?
That could
be. It was only in four episodes.
Oh, wow.
One of these days, really? Four episodes. That's Oliver. True.
Yes.
What season?
It had to be the last season. Why wouldn't it be the last?
I don't know. You tell me.
Because Oliver, you know, whenever they came up with that jump the shark thing, which was a reference to Happy Days, then they would also then always follow that up with, like, in Brady Bunch terms, it's when Cousin Oliver arrived. That's when that show jumped the shark.
Pulling in Oliver?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're rehashing and recycling the young kid.
Because the young kids have grown up and they're gangly and weird looking and they're no longer cute, so they need a new cute kid to come in.
Right, exactly.
That's what I said.
Did they do that with Full House? What happened after those twins got grown up?
I think they gave those twins drugs to keep them, you know, cute. Like some kind of injection to keep them young.
Yeah.
Didn't they? Is that for real? You're just making that up.
I'm just making that up.
Back in Gabe Rodriguez days, TV was a hit parade. Everybody had it made. Those were the Gabes.
Gabe Rodriguez's TV Corner.
Hey, everybody, it's Scott McCoy.
Hey.
That's how you pronounce that, right?
Yes, that's right. Very good.
That's difficult.
Yes.
Do people usually have a problem with that?
McCaughey, I get it all. McCagey, I've got lots of different ones, but I can't, you know, I can't like get upset about it because it was built to be a lifetime of mispronouncing. Yeah.
But it sounds exactly like your sort of adopted kind of like handle, the MCOI, McCoy.
Yes, it's right. Exactly. Yeah.
So there you go. Scott.
At some point. That's a good one.
He's an oi guy.
Yeah, that's right. Oi bands.
So where are you now? Are you
Whatever
from
happened to the oi bands?
The oi bands? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the question. Did AC/DC start the oi band with TNT? Or were there oi bands before that?
I don't know. That's a good question. That's a good question. I think of all being British bands, but oi bands. But I guess there were some over here, too. But yeah. I don't know about Australia.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
Are you from Portland or are you from Seattle?
Well, I'm not from either. I'm from California, pretty much. But that was I was in Seattle for 25 years, so that's when my air quotes rock career started.
Right.
So I've been thought of being from Seattle for a long time because all the rest of the Young Fresh Fellows still live in Seattle too. But I moved to Portland like, God, almost 20 years ago now.
Jesus. Yeah. So you moved from California to Seattle.
Yes.
Why?
Well, my friend Chuck Carroll and I, who is the original lead guitar player and co-founder of the Young Fresh Fellows, we were playing in bands around the Bay Area and we were getting tired of it because it was just like, it was kind of like back in the pay to play kind of years, you know, and we're like, this is just stupid. We should just do something else. So Chuck drove around the country one summer and looked for cool places that he thought where we could do something in music, not necessarily a band. And that was right when they had started that BAM, Bay Area Music free magazine that they were handing out that was kind of like the first one of those. And so we thought we could do something like that. And so we just kind of randomly decided on Seattle. Chuck had narrowed it to Tucson and Seattle. And I used to live in Tucson when I was a kid and I liked it, but thought, well, Seattle sounds like something different. Let's go there.
Right.
So we just threw all our records and guitars in his BW van and just drove up there and started living in a basement for $100 a month.
Wow. So I mean, what year is this?
End of 1979.
Okay. So what is, I mean, we've all heard the stories about the Seattle scene, the grunge area, but what was it like back then? before
it
that.
It wasn't very happening. there was a lot of bars where you could play Wednesday through Saturday, three sets a night, you know, mostly doing typically doing covers and stuff like that. There was a lot of that going on, but there was a small punk rock scene of people who were making their own 45s and putting them out. And, you know, they would play in like a, you know, Oddfellows Hall and stuff like that. They rent a hall, Eagles Hall or whatever, and do punk rock shows where, you know, 100 people would show up and then they'd get busted by the cops. Right. And that would be the end of the show. Right. So there was a lot of that going on, but I started playing with this band called the Dinette Set that was mostly a girl group of three girls. So it was like the Ronettes and everything, but it was like with a two guitars, bass and drums. So it was kind of like the Stones with the Ronettes kind of thing, right. You know? And it was, so we kind of surprisingly got pretty popular and we're doing that four night a week, Wednesday through Saturday, three nights, three sets a night thing, which I was also working in a record store and got to be kind of a burnout, but yeah, it was really fun. I was young then. I enjoyed it. It was really, really awesome. And meanwhile, Chuck and I were recording all our songs on four tracks, you know, and that's what turned into the Young Fresh Fellows. We made a cassette and sent it out to friends. And then we decided, let's make a record of this stuff. And that was the beginning of it all.
So were you writing for the Seattle Rocket at the time?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
I fell right into that because by the time in the 3 months since Chuck had been up there and said, this would be a good place to do a magazine, we came up and they put, you know, the second issue of the Rocket was in the first bar we went into. We're like, oh shit, we got burned. But so we just went and started working with them and I started writing for them immediately and also driving around in my 65 Comet Caliente and going to all the newspaper boxes. Because it was originally an add-on to this weekly paper called the Seattle Sun, which cost a quarter. And so, you know, that was my first job in Seattle, was going around and collecting the coins from the coin boxes all over the city. Which was a good way to learn to get around the city for sure.
So how did you put out your first record? Did you put it out with a label? Did you put it out yourself?
We put it out with the Pop Llama Products.
Oh, wow.
It was a guy we met named Conrad Uno who he was like a local sound man and he would do sound for the Dinette Set at shows we've played and stuff like that. And I told him that Chuck and I, we want to record a record. And he's like, oh, really? Well, I've got a label and a recording studio and I'll record you for free if you put the record out on my label. And
so, was that Egg? Was that the studio?
Yeah, Egg, yeah. And okay. And so I was like, well, that sounds amazing. That's because we'd been going around looking at studios and priced them out and figuring out how we could do it. And but it was just great that Uno fell into it and just said, hey, I'll do it for you guys for free if you'll put it out on my label. What we didn't really know is the label didn't really exist. The label put out like two Christmas collection cassettes. And so he wanted to get it off the ground and he thought, well, this would be cool. If these guys want to do vinyl, do a vinyl record, this will be a good way to get my label off the ground. And it was awesome for us because we got so much time to spend in the studio compared to what we would have been if we'd hired a studio for $20 an hour or whatever it was, then we would have been like on the clock, seriously.
Right.
And we weren't on the clock at all. And it was just became really, really fun time to make a record with Conrad. We didn't know what we were doing, but that's the beauty of it, I guess. You know?
Well, they were walking down the street. I'd never seen a couple young fresh fellows before. Well, there was something about the way they combed their hair and something about the clothes that they wore. Well, they don't act so cool, they're just regular Joes. Well, they're the young fresh fellows now, nobody knows. Well, I never seen a couple young fresh fellows before. I went and told them I was new downtown and I did not know the proper spots to hang around. Well, they were awfully cool, those guys.
guys answered me true. They said,
just stick with us, man. We'll show you what to do.
They took me to a rock club where the girls were the most. We imparted our own brews in our beer sponge coats. Now, I never knew I was a young, fresh fellow before. Young fresh fellas, you see, heating up some chili for our evening meal and catching the beef every day on TV. Well, we're not out to make a real big splash, but we wouldn't mind a record and a little hard cash. Now, I never knew I was a young fresh fellow before.
So, I mean, when I listen to Young Fresh Fellows, it's really hard for me to pick out your influences. Who would you say they were? What was the first band that really turned your head around?
Well, the first band that really turned my head around was the Beatles, of course. But I guess the Beatles weren't the biggest influence at the time, because we were listening to, you know, I mean, at that point, I was working in a record store on the Ave in Seattle, and it was, you know, there was a lot of punk rock going on, a lot of Buzzcocks and Sex Pistols and all that kind of stuff, which you might hear a little bit, but we're on the poppier side of punk for sure. But I'd say, but like that first record, The Who sounds really, there's a lot of Who influence going on there. Surf music. Our drummer Tad was really into surf music, and Chuck and I were too. We loved the Fantastic Baggies and all these weird surf bands like that. But you know, the band that Chuck and I were super into right around then, like when we first moved to Seattle, was The Beat, the Paul Collins Beat, you know? And that's why the English Beat had to be called the English Beat,
right?
Because they were The Beat in UK. That was, they made that first, Paul Collins and made the first record just called The Beat. And that was just, it was just a real great power pop, classic rock and power pop record. And so that's what we were really into right at that point, you know?
Right. So what was that first tour? Well, I mean, when did you take the steps out of Seattle?
We didn't go till 1985, because the record came out in 84, and like April 84, 40 years ago today. That's partly kind of why we're going out and about, trying to get out and about a little bit this coming year. It's not going to be a lot, but we're going to do something. But 85 was the first tour we did. And that was kind of we didn't have any idea what we were doing. We just, you know, Conrad had sent out some like 30 copies of the LP to radio stations that he got a list from somebody, you know, just randomly. Yeah. And some of them came back with like, hey, you know, you're number one in Bloomington, Indiana, you know, at the college station or something like that. We're like, oh, we should go play. And so we just rented a van and just drove out there and, you know, didn't really have guarantees or anything like that. We had one college gig in Denison, Ohio, where they were paying us $800. We're like, wow, $800. That's going to float the whole tour.
Right.
Which it didn't really, but, but gas was cheaper then. And, you know, it was, we were just having the time of our lives. So that was 85. And that was kind of a big deal, because we were one of the first bands in Seattle that went, it was before pre-grunge and everything, and we were kind of like one of the first bands in Seattle that went out across the country, and we got our second album, Topsy Turvy, which came out in 85, got a big review in Rolling Stone by David Frick. And so that was kind of a big deal. Everyone's like, wow, you guys are super popular now. We're like, no, we're not. but it doesn't work that way. but you know, it was really cool. It gave us the confidence to go out and just see what happens, you know. And it was the classic thing. You go out and play in front of 50 people the first time, and hopefully the next time there's 100, and next time there's 200, you know, that kind of thing, which tended to work at times.
I mean, can you really, I don't know, explain what the difference between the college scene of the 80s was to the alternative scene of the 90s? I mean, what was the big difference to you?
Yeah, I don't know when it switched over, because now, I mean, it seems like, I mean, are there even really college stations still? I guess there are, but they don't have the power they did.
Right.
Because back then, if you were getting, I mean, depended on which station it was, but some of the college stations would pack a punch. You know, if you had them playing your record, you had a pretty good chance of having a decent show in town, and they might sponsor it at a local bar or whatever and get behind it. But, yeah, I don't know when that dried up, but it seems like it's been a long time since it's been like that, you know? Like the first time we went to first tour we did, we got shows at CMJ in New York. You know, New York was where they had the CMJ convention, which is College Music Journal or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
The big thing. It was kind of like South by Southwest, but before South by Southwest, and it was all over New York City, you know, all these shows. But they weren't necessarily popular bands. You know, they were all bands that were just coming out, and they would get behind new groups, you know, because college music was really, you know, they were trying not to play what the popular stations were playing. You know, they were definitely the alternative then, you know.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And a couple cities would have, you know, commercial alternative stations, you know, which I guess now everybody has those, but they were kind of few and far between back then, you know.
Like who?
Well, like KCMU is a college station in University of Washington, but then it became, then there was KJET, which was also like a commercial alternative station, which didn't, you know, it was around for 4 or 5 years, but went away. But then I think there was one in New York.
Well, yeah, we had WLIR on Long Island.
Yeah, LIR. That's right. That's the one. Yeah, because they had us come out in 87. They flew us out to play a big show for them because they were, Amy Grant was kind of a little bit of a hit for us, and the LIR was really into it, and so they flew us out there just to play at one show, which was, we thought was really crazy, but right. It was at the Ritz with us and the Liars. It was pretty fun, but yeah.
So what was the story behind writing Amy Grant?
It was just, you know, it was just, I mean, the fellows didn't, we took our music really seriously, but we didn't take ourselves seriously. You know, we played live. We just wanted to have a good time and have fun and wanted people to have fun, you know? And, so I was driving to practice one day from West Seattle, and I just got this thing in my head about Amy Grant. It just, the lyrics just were rolling coming out. And I was like, I realized I didn't know anything about Amy Grant. Yeah. So I said, I knew she was a Christian singer. That's all I knew. And that she was popular at the time. So I was just like, oh, I'm going to poke fun at her without reading anything or finding out anything about her, you know, just, so it was like, I just made stuff up, you know, that's what I did back then. I didn't really worry about what was true and what wasn't. And I can figure it's a song. Anything goes in a song. You know, right. You'd say whatever you want, you know, and you might have to go back and rethink things later or regret some things. But, you know, I mean, I did kind of regret Amy Grant because it got to be kind of popular, and it was such a dumb song. I mean, yeah. I mean, I wrote it and we played it. Like, I got the practice. I said, I just thought of these words, and we just started playing the song. We just like made it up in 2 seconds, you know? You know, it does have all of two chords to it too, I think. So, so it was just, it was kind of a silly song and people liked it, but, I felt a little embarrassed about it as the years went on, but especially like Amy Grant, you know, heard the song and she was such a good sport about it. You know, she would like sing it in interviews. People say, hey, have you heard this song? And she go, yeah. And she starts singing, Amy Grant. She's like singing in interviews and stuff. And I was like, oh man, she's cool. Damn. Right. Why did I do making fun of her and she's totally cool. She's totally cool about it. So, anyway, like 10 or 15 years later, we wrote a second song about her that was a lot sweeter, a lot nicer, but we didn't put it on the record. So
it's so good. So who are some of the bands that you were touring with that like you really got on with that you would say were your contemporaries?
Well, the Replacements were our, okay. our big buddies, you know, which was a, you know, it was probably not the best thing for either of us to be touring together because we really egged each other on and none of us needed egging on at all.
Right.
But so there were some pretty disastrous shows. That was like in 87. We played with them first in 85 and we did a couple tours with them in 87. Yeah, those were really, really fun, but pretty messy. Pretty messy.
Well, what were the audiences thinking? What were the clubs thinking when you played a show that you thought was bad?
The really kind of famous one is the Portland show in December of 87 when we just didn't really try to do any music. I mean, we played songs, but it was just like we played in San Francisco the night before and, you know, driving kind of all night, you know, it's you know, those aren't really good back to back, you know, right. Portland 800 miles or whatever. Yeah. You know, so we were a total wreck and we just started pounding drinks at, you know, at soundcheck and just egging each other on. And we were just raising hell. And Paul had the idea we should all switch clothes before the show. So we're wearing their clothes and they're wearing ours, which is funny because, you know, I couldn't even fit into Westerberg's clothes, you know, he's so skinny, you know, and then we had all these kind of costumes that we had because the fellows would wear really ridiculous stuff. And I had this, we called it Leonardo da Vinci robe, this really fancy velour robe that I would wear, which I'd been wearing it shows like off and on for a couple of years. And that was gone that night because Paul went out. Paul not only just put on that, he put on like all the clothes in my bag, basically, and threw them out into the audience. So, you know, there went all my clothes. And you know, they came up like halfway through our set because we were stinking it up so bad. They came out halfway through and took our instruments and launched into a joyous medley of Hey, Good Looking, right, and Silent Night, you know? So it was really great. And I don't even remember any songs they played. I don't even know if they played any real songs. It was just horrible. And we threw the couch out of the second story window of the dressing room, and Paul was swinging on the chandelier in there, and it came out of the ceiling. And you know, it was the promoter wasn't happy. I don't think the crowd was happy at all. Although now, you know, I live in Portland now. Everybody I talk to is like, "Oh yeah, I saw that show. That was amazing." You know,
right?
Yeah,
you know, right. But was it?
They all weren't there,
right?
But I mean, it was a packed house, but you know, but it was. I don't think anybody was really thinking it was really good at the time.
Well, Paul felt so bad about it. He wrote a song about it, right? Didn't they write?
Yeah, he wrote that song, Portland, and then on the their next record that came out, I think Don't Tell a Soul, I think it was.
Yeah.
Had written etched in the runoff groove, said Sorry Portland.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they recognized it for sure. Yeah. For sure. But yeah, then there were some other shows like that too. There was a big one at Variety Arts Center in LA. We were playing two shows there. It was like their record release party for
Pleased to Meet Me.
Pleased to Meet Me. I was thinking it was Pleased to Meet Me. Yeah. One of the nights, Chris Mars got super, super drunk, which is, he was usually the guy who kind of held it together for them maybe back then. But they said every once in a while he doesn't, and he turns into Pappy the Clown. And
right.
And so he was definitely on his way to being Pappy that night. And Paul, I said, looks like we're going to see Pappy tonight. And Paul said, I think there's going to be a whole lot of Pappies tonight. I ended up writing a song called Whole Lot of Pappies, for the fellas that we did. But, he couldn't play. He played like three songs and then he just gave up. And so our drummer got up and played some songs with them. And that was a really bad idea, 'cause that was like a big show with all the record label people were there and everything like that, which of course probably made them more likely for them to do that.
Right.
Do that thing, you know? But yeah, so there was a lot of stuff like that, but some of the shows were awesome. So some of them were really, really great. You know? Yeah.
So how did you meet Peter Buck?
I met him outside a show. R.E.M. was playing at the Paramount in Seattle, and the fellows were playing the same night. So I couldn't go to the show, but I went. I'd heard that he had liked our first record because he did an interview on KCMU or some college station in Seattle. And he's like, "Oh yeah. Do you know the Young Fresh Fellows? I got their record. It's really, really good." And the DJ said, "Yeah, they've got a new single out." He goes, "Oh, will you get it for me and bring it to the show?" so he knew me. And so they were playing at the Paramount. We were playing the same night. We couldn't go, but I went, and met him at the bus and gave him a copy of this record we'd done as a side band called The Squirrels. And that was the first time I met him. And then after that, you know, we just run into each other. He'd come out to our shows when we played in Athens and, you know, just end up going over to his house, you know, and listen to music all night and having a party, air drumming to Big Star and stuff like that. You
was
know?
This when he was wearing pajamas?
I don't know if he was back then. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like, we just go after the show, but I don't think he was wearing pajamas then, but, we just got to be friends, just, you know, just like you do in REM travel. I can, in driving around playing bands in the scene, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, but right. then you know, he came to Seattle in 92 to they were mixing Automatic for the People there. And so they were there for a month, and he came and he just like, I just got to Seattle. I'm going to be here for a month. You want to get together and have dinner or something? And I said, yeah, sure. So we just got together and just started hanging out a lot. And then he ended up meeting a woman there and getting married and staying there. He kind of never left. And so we just started playing music together a lot and doing side stuff, you know, that turned into the Minus Five.
So what was going on with Young Fresh Fellows at this time?
Well, that was the thing. The Fellows were still playing then, but not a whole lot. And by the time 94 rolled around, we really weren't doing much at all. I wouldn't say we were taking a hiatus, but we just weren't doing much because everybody was playing in other bands and all that stuff, you know. I think we kind of felt like a lull was coming into our career, you know.
Right.
And so we weren't breaking up or anything, but he asked if I'd be interested in going on tour with REM as a you know, an extra guy. And he said, but I don't want to do it if it's gonna mean you're gonna leave the Fellows or it's gonna wreck your band, because I don't want to do that, you know. So I was like, well, I think I could take a year, because we're not really, don't have anything going, we don't have anything scheduled or anything like that. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I had to try out and everything. It wasn't a sure deal, but I talked to the rest of the Fellows about it. They were all supportive. They were all fine with doing other stuff too, because they all played with a lot of other bands and everything
right.
too. By that point, you know, we were always doing spinoffs and doing other things. And Kurt had the Fastbacks and
right, the Fastbacks.
Yeah, and you know, Jim was playing in the Pickets then, I think. And yeah, there was a lot of other things going on. So it wasn't a problem. So I did that. And then that's when the Fellows, I mean, the first Minus Five record came out sometime when we were on tour that year too. So, had that going as a side project as well. And then once I started playing with Peter, you know, he just always wants to do stuff. And when REM finishes a tour, he thinks, well, we're probably not going to do anything for at least a year, you know. And they'll take a year off, and then they'll start making a record. That'll take another year, and then they'll go on tour. So it's like every 3 years, maybe,
right.
you know. Although I did work on all the records after that too. So that kept me busy. But we were dragging each other into numerous projects,
right?
Making records with Mark Eitzel, doing Tuatara, doing Robin Hitchcock, you know, just on and on and on. Tired Pony.
All right, we got to talk about Robin Hitchcock, but before we get there, I have to talk to you about that ARP Odyssey on Leave. That's you, right?
It is.
It's the best part of the song. It's the best song on the record. Like, how did that come about?
Oh, it was funny. It was like they had this ARP Odyssey, and I was like, we got to use this, and I used it on another song, Undertow. I used it on that one too, but that one, it was just like they wanted something, a blippy thing going on and on. And I was trying to figure out a way to do it. And I was like, okay, the way to do it is just like to get this one switch, is an octave switch, and just switch it back and forth the whole time. So that's me just doing like my wrist is just going back and forth the whole 7 minutes of the song.
You only holding down one note on the keyboard?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just going back.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Cause I think our Odyssey, I don't even know if it was polyphonic. I'm not sure, but yeah, I was just, it was just a noise, really. It was like a white noise thing, but just doing the switch going back and forth was what made that sound happen, which is funny because when we started the song, it was, you know, it was kind of a nice little song, and it turned into a total
and then you ruined it,
a noise fest. But
on tour with them when Bill had the aneurysm?
Yeah.
How scary was that?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was terrifying. And it was really sad too, because, you know, I mean, he got the operation while we were all still there in Lausanne, and went to see him and say goodbye, because like, well, we're rest of the tour is canceled, you know, whatever. And we didn't know when we were going to get back at it. And he was lying in the hospital. His whole head was shaved and cut open, big Frankenstein scar and all this stuff, you know? And I was like, all right, Bill, you look really good. He goes, hey, if this is looking good, then I don't want to hear about it or something like that. But yeah. And then they had to send everybody home, because, you know, it costs a lot of money to keep 60 people on tour out there or whatever. So they had to send everybody home. And then we ended up coming back like 6 weeks later or something. It was like, Jesus. Built like a really, really quick recovery. And so we canceled all the rest of Europe. And I think they pushed back the United States, and they kind of scrambled some more stuff and put it in November, but Bill came back strong. It was amazing. I was really worried about it, but he came back, and he was amazing. And he was a trooper. He filled the tour. And then I think we didn't know for a while, but I think he felt like he was maybe done with it.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
He didn't want to tempt fate anymore.
No, he didn't. And, yeah, and I think he just decided 17 years of rock and roll was or 15 years, you know, whatever it was. He said it's been enough for him, and you know, he still makes a lot of music. He's still great, and it's great to see him. We see him every time we go to Athens, which is often, and he's still amazing, and he's always coming up with cool music ideas and stuff like that. Yeah. But
so then you're going out on tour with Robin Hitchcock, which is kind of crazy. I mean, I know Peter had known him for a while, but I mean, what was your first impression of just that first night of hanging out with Robin Hitchcock?
Well, I was a huge fan of the Soft Boys. I mean, I heard the first Soft Boys record when it came out in the record store I worked in, and we were just, me and the people who were there just flipped out over it. And so I was a huge fan, and I'd talked to him. Well, the fellows opened some shows for him. Like, God, pretty early on in '86, we opened for him at Berkeley Square. I remember we opened with Give It to the Soft Boys because we figured he's not going to play it, because he's in the Egyptians now, and he wasn't really playing a lot of Soft Boys stuff, but it was a little cheeky thing to do because we didn't like check it out with him.
No.
So, yeah, you don't mind. But he's like, well, he wasn't that excited about it afterwards. He was like, well, you know, he goes, you know, I don't mind, but now it's just everybody's going to leave the show saying, oh, it was great, the opening band did Give It to the Soft Boys, you know. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess, sorry. But you know, but he liked us, and we were just, like I said, just huge fans of his. And then over the years, I opened up for him when he was touring solo. I'd opened a couple shows for him solo, and I talked to him about producing the early Minus Five stuff. I wanted him to produce a record by us and stuff like that. And he didn't really feel like he was a producer.
Right.
Going to do it. But you know, we hit it off and we got pretty friendly. And then, when I was doing stuff with Peter, of course, Peter and him were pretty tight. Back then they'd done a lot of stuff together. And so, it made sense at that point when we started I don't know how it happened that we started playing with him and became that band, the Venus Three. But we did at some point. We just decided to make it a band thing and do some recording. And it's a really great band, and the records were really good. So it kept going for a while, you know, for like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years or something. Maybe we did a lot together, and then we didn't.
Yeah.
But
you've never not been busy. I mean, what's the story with that Down with Wilco record? What's going on with that?
That was a thing that Jeff and I just kind of cooked up to do a record together. And I'm not sure. It was weird because we talked about it for years, because I'd been friends with Jeff for a long time and knew all the Wilco guys and everything. They first met them when he was probably a teenager. They opened for the Fellows. Uncle Tupelo opened for the Young Fresh mm-hmm. Fellows in 1988, I think, in St. Louis. And then he moved to Chicago, and Chicago was kind of our best city, you know, besides Seattle. You know, it was kind of like we had Lounge Acts was our kind of clubhouse, and we just we could play there anytime we wanted to. And because Sue Miller was a good friend of ours, she put on our first shows in Chicago and even before Lounge Acts. And so we always stayed with her, and we're just having great times with her. She'll still love her to this day. She's the best. And so then when Jeff started hanging out with her, we were constantly seeing each other. And at some point, and we brought Wilco on tour with REM a couple different years when we were together. And so we kind of wrote a couple songs together and stuff like that. And we thought, let's do a record together and a Minus Five record. And I call it Down with Wilco. And it was a weird time because it kept getting put off a little bit. And then by the time we scheduled recording time, the whole thing was happening with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. They did it, and then they got turned down by the label and everything. So it bought them a lot of time. It was a good time for him to do a record with me, but at the same time, the Wilco that I thought we were doing the record with was slowly like at the last like week or two before I was coming out there. He's like, oh yeah, Ken's not going to be playing drums with us. I got this guy Glenn. He's really good. You'll really like him. And then he's like, Jay's not going to be there either. Right. You know,
right?
But I was like, well, whatever you say, man. It's going to be fun. We're going to do it. And I just got out there, and we went to the loft the night before, and we listened to a bunch of records, and I played him a bunch of songs that I had, and we kind of came up with ideas for them and arrangements, and we just started recording the next day. They didn't have recording. They weren't really recording. They didn't really have the finished studio at the loft then. So we were recording at Soma, that place. So we did that and Michael Jorgensen was the engineer there, who ended up being in Wilco very shortly after that. We just started recording. And of course we started recording on September 10th, 2001. And so the next day, all shit broke loose. And it was really a horrible time. But we just thought, well, what are we going to do? We sat around and watched TV all day and just feeling like lost and horrible. And then everybody was like, let's just go and make music. Let's do something. You know, so we did. And we played a show at the Abbey Tavern on the 15th afterwards. And people were just going crazy at that show. I think everybody was just so wiped out over what had happened. And it was pretty cathartic.
Yeah.
And then I went back in December, and we did some more tracks. And then record came out a couple of years later because of course the record, the label that I was making the record for, they went out of, or they got bought out by Hollywood Records or something. So I had to find a different label for the, So we kind of went through the same thing that we just gone through with that. They just,
you should have took it to Reprise.
Yeah. That would have been great.
I saw you crying in the Quaker choir. They don't swing so low. There's no religion like old time religion. It's a heavy snow that puts you in the mood for love. And I was in the mood, yeah, I was in the mood. But if I was stronger, you know I never would have hurt you that way.
Well, I mean, even going back to the fabulous sounds of the Pacific Northwest, it seems like you do these records that aren't really concept records, but they have a theme. I mean,
they do. They do.
That's something you always like to do?
Yeah, I do. I mean, even if there's not an obvious theme, there is to me, you know? Like, I started doing, well, the Fab Sounds was kind of like that. And then the second record, Topsy Turvy, had a total theme in my head. You know, it was just about being crazy and being lost and trying to find your way. So all the songs I picked for that were because of that. So I always try to kind of group songs together that belong together, you know, that have a message to me at least, you know?
Yeah.
We did that pretty constantly. The third record, The Men Who Love Music, was, you know, that was that. And it's just that's just a thing for me. I don't want to rely on it. I'm never gonna say like it's got to be this has to apply to it, but I always group songs that have a feeling that they're kind of saying something in the same direction, right? Something like that.
What was the impetus behind that Monkees record?
That was, you know, that was part of a five record set that I put out in 2013. And I put out the single record because that was a whole record that I grouped because there was five songs about the Monkees, or one about each of the Monkees and one about Voice and Heart, who right. wrote a lot of their songs. And then the other side was all songs about other bands or friends of mine that were in bands. So it was all about real people.
And
so
Robert Ryan.
Yes, Robert Ryan.
How does Robert Ryan find his way onto a Monkees?
Well, because it was all songs about real people.
Okay,
they're all songs about real people. They weren't any made up bands, because I've written a lot of songs about made up bands too. But those are all real people. So yeah, that's how Robert Ryan got in, because he was a real person. It was a song about a real person. So,
what's your favorite Robert Ryan movie?
Oh man. Oh my God. There's so many. Well, I love The Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
Wild Bunch is amazing. That's not his movie, but he's great in it. And there's that one. I always have a hard time remembering the title. It's One Day Till Tomorrow or something. It's with Harry Belafonte.
Yeah.
It's the main guy. And Robert
Odds
Wise.
Against Tomorrow.
Odds Against Tomorrow.
Odds Against
right.
Tomorrow. That's it. I love that one. That's so great. And
you ever seen Day of the Outlaw?
No, I don't know that one.
It's this Western with Burl Ives in it and Tina Louise from Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, I got to see that. I got to see that. I'm all about TCM, man. Yeah. I watch TCM. I just live for that station. That's it's always through it. Yeah, and so you know, it's so funny because Robert Ryan plays some really horrible characters in him.
Right.
By all historical things, he was a really nice guy, a Mel guy. He was a Quaker, you know,
right.
Very peaceful guy. But you know, there's that one where he's the anti-Semitic guy. What's that one called?
Crossfire?
Crossfire. That's it.
That's it. Crossfire.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So he plays some pretty despicable people.
It wasn't like that at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're a total lifer. What keeps you going? You know, I mean, I know you had a, you know, speaking of aneurysms and so you had a pretty close brush.
Yeah.
You had a stroke. I mean, what did you have to change to keep doing this?
That's a good question. I was determined to not stop doing it, yeah. You know, because I figured, well, I made it through that, so I should keep doing it. But it was a big adjustment, because I I mean, I started making music right away and making and writing songs that, that were turned into the Stroke Manor album, the Minus Five record, that are all songs, like, words I wrote. A lot of them wrote in the ICU and stuff like that. But I couldn't even, didn't really have any language then, so they don't really make any sense. But some people have said, well, they're not that different from my normal songs, but well, maybe, but I don't know. But they felt really different to me. And it's still really different for me to write songs. It's just harder to write songs because words were always the thing that came so easy to me. I was really good with melodies and stuff like that. But I've had to learn how to. It's good because it's made me focus on melody more because it's so much harder to get the words out now. And I used to just be able to spit out the words and I would just rattle them off. But now I can't remember the words, the songs too. So, right. So I have to, you know, I don't do a teleprompter because that's too technical for me. It seems like you're really committing to not be able to ever remember any songs again.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that, but I do have a music stand lots of times that I have to use. And if it's a new song, I can't remember the words at all. The weird thing is the songs I can remember, that the songs that came back to me are all the earliest songs that I sang the most. And so now it's like, it's kind of cool to do a tour for the Fab Sounds, because those are the songs that I can remember more than any other songs, because I probably sang them more than any songs because I sang them for such a long time. You know, not all of them, but, you know, most of them are ones that were just in our canon and I can
sing. It's also when you had less songs back then. You know, you didn't have, so many goddamn songs now.
That's,
you know?
True. That's true. Yeah. You know what that's like. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You can probably remember all your songs, but
no.
you've got a lot of songs and that those are, it's hard to keep them all in order. So now I feel like if I can ever get to one where I can remember one, and then I'm going to add a new song. I got to replace that one. You know, it's like you shove the other one aside so you can make room for another one. But
right.
But it's really hard for me because I still just really don't really know when I'm opening my mouth what's going to come out, you know, if the right thing's going to come out. And lots of times I'm singing a song and I go, okay, what's the next line? I have no idea. And then you just sing and sometimes it pops in. Sometimes it shows up and sometimes it doesn't. So,
right.
You know, but yeah, I can think back all the times I saw Westerberg kind of making up the words or getting them wrong. And I think, I guess, you know, nobody's going to really hold it against me.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. 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 So,
but, all right. So, Gabe has a question, but
I'm standing here saying, let's not even bother with this.
What?
All right, here's a question that Gabe asked.
I've been sitting here listening to the stories, and obviously, you know, you sound like your wheelhouse is, you know, 80s, you know, independent college music, but just out of curiosity, do you have any heavy metal records behind you in that fabulous collection of records you got back there? That's not my question, but I'm just curious.
I think I don't have many. I don't have many. I have a Metallica one, but I'm Injustice for All, the double album, but I'm selling it. But not that I don't like them. It's just I've got so much stuff to listen to that I just have to put it. But one I really like is the Stormtroopers of Death, SOD.
I was just talking about that record the other day. Wow.
First record of that, because we did a song on one of the Fellows records. You know, there's a March of the SOD on that record, and we did one that was kind of our version of that. And we kind of quote from it a lot. So that's one. I'm trying to think, you know, I mean, I guess AC/DC doesn't really count for metal, right?
Not really.
Yeah. And Deep Purple, you know, I mean, those are all hard rock bands, but they're not metal really. So I don't really think I really ever really latched on to a metal band that really meant a lot to me, you know?
That's all right. Our canned question is, if you had to pick between two bands, you can only listen to one or the other, you're on a deserted island, would you pick The Replacements or Iron Maiden? And, you know.
The Replacements. Yeah.
We know what the
answer
is.
That's an easy one. Now, I have seen Iron Maiden live. Right. I went and saw Iron Maiden the Scorpions and Girls School. In and you could guess which band I was probably going to see.
Girls School.
Girls School, that's right. That's right.
And around 81 or 82?
Yeah, probably right around there.
It had to be 82. Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
I loved Girls School, and I loved Motorhead. Because, Motorhead, I guess, I don't know if they count either, but I love Motorhead. You know, they're great. Motorhead. They're not so much a metal band either, but I was a big Girls School fan. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Gabe. What's the best? All right, so we do a thing around here called What's the Best? What's the Best? And since you've written so many songs about bands and musicians, we thought we'd do a What's the Best of songs about bands and musicians, right?
Uh-huh. I think I know what mine would be off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, we're going to go one at a time.
Okay.
And you'll go first, and Gabe will go second. I go third. Ben goes last.
And as somebody involved with the baseball project, maybe it makes sense that we do this draft style.
Yeah.
So if somebody else names one of your favorites, you got to take it off your list and come up with a different one.
So do we keep going for a while?
Yes, three rounds of
us doing this.
And so it's one song at a time from each one of us for each round.
Okay, this could be hard, but I know mine is The Ballad of Mott.
Oh.
Yeah. That's my all-time favorite, at least as far as I can think of off the top of my head.
Right.
Okay.
Why? Why is that the, best?
It's the story of the band. It's the story of the band as they were breaking up, you know? And they, of course, they came back and had their biggest success afterwards, but it was the story of the band as they were breaking up. And it talks about the general, what it's like being in a band, and also specifically addresses each person in the band.
Right.
Know? Yeah.
Did you ever read his book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Diary of a Rock and Roll Star. Yeah. Meant a lot to a lot of people, I think. I think it kind of started people thinking about writing bands about being in a band. Writing books about being in a band.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Gabe, what do you got?
All right, I might have misunderstood this concept here. So
I'm pretty sure you did.
But this is a song about a band, but it's a song written by a band about themselves.
Okay. That's cool.
Well, that's what
counts.
That's what the Ballad of Mott was, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. Okay. Well, this one.
Just as long as it's not Iron Maiden by Iron Maiden, because that's songs about.
You took that off my list, but
okay.
This is
about a band. That's about a torture device.
It was not about a band, but anyway, Minor Threat by Minor Threat.
Wow,
that's a good one.
Is it? Is it about the band though?
We're just a Minor Threat. Yes, we're just a Minor Threat. Yeah. I don't care.
No, isn't it like talking about them as a group of people? Not as a band. It's not we are Minor Threat. Yes, we are Minor Threat. It's like all these people around us.
It's a Minor Threat. It's a fine line, isn't it? It's a fine line.
I think it passes. Ben, ruling?
I'll let it stand. What do I care? I don't give a fuck. Whatever.
Let's move on.
Yeah. Good man, Ben.
Is it my turn?
Yes. Yeah. Scott Lewis.
Okay, my first pick is Alex Chilton by The Replacements.
Yeah. Motherfucker.
That's
a sucks so fucking bad.
It's a great one. It's a great one.
I think I took Ben's.
Okay. Oh, really?
Ben, why would you have picked this song?
Well, it's not only one of my favorite songs about a band or a musical artist, it's also just one of my favorite songs. I mean, just a great fucking song.
Great vocal performance, and it was a really cool way to get people who were listening to The Replacements into Big Star.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, that is, you can't go wrong with that one. That's great. They actually would always try to play it really good when they played it live, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They didn't fuck with that one.
No, they didn't. They didn't. I think it had a special place for them, too, somewhat, you know?
Their one moment of reverence?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess it might have had a little bit more, but yeah, that was... That was good. Although, you know, of course, I'm sure Alex Chilton, I don't know if he liked the song. It's hard to say. He might have been like, fuck that.
Yeah. It's okay. It's okay. It's a good attempt.
Yeah, right.
What do you got, Ben?
All right. Well, I will do the follow up to that because it's sort of like the story. There was this whole goofy thing that happened because of Alex Chilton. So then my pick for number one of my three is High Where the Replacements by They Might Be Giants. And the story behind that song was that They Might Be Giants heard the Replacements song Alex Chilton and decided if they wrote a song about the Replacements, then Alex Chilton would write a song about them, which, as far as I know, never happened, but that was their game.
Yeah, it probably didn't happen.
But so two-thirds of that chain.
That is a great song, though.
Yeah.
It's a great one. I forgot all about that one. There's so many I probably haven't even thought of. But, so is it my turn again?
Yeah, it's number two.
This is going to be good. Saturday Gigs by Mott the Hoople.
You're just going to do Mott the Hoople song?
Two. I was like, somebody will pick Saturday Gigs. No, they didn't. I'll pick both of them. Because that's like the last single they did when they're looking back on, you know, because I think he probably knew they were going to break up again or whatever.
Right.
It's a really beautiful, fond remembrance of how great it was to be in that band and to be in a band. But, you know, it's like, do you remember the Saturday gigs? We do, you know. And he talks about specific gigs that they did that were really famous ones. Then we got to Croydon, you know. It's like, it's awesome. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And so I mean, Ballad of Mott, those two are kind of, you can't top them for me. And I think the reason, part of the reason I wrote so many songs about my band,
right,
or other bands, but like I wrote a lot about songs about my band. It's like, because Mott, they laid the trail for that. You know, they said it's okay to talk about yourself and to write about yourself and
be self-referential.
Yeah, self-referential, which. The Young Fresh Fellows are ashamedly self-referential. We had to be. Somebody had to write about us.
Yeah, I think a major piece of the puzzle is becoming clear for me tonight.
Yeah.
It's Mott the Hoople. All right. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's so true. And, I mean, nobody's going to bring up this song, but just since you brought up They Might Be Giants, they actually mentioned the Young Fresh Fellows in one of their songs too, which was like a lot of people actually heard about us because of that song. Like, oh yeah, you guys are in that They Might Be Giants song. Yeah. so you know, it comes around, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Gabe.
Okay,
I'll take this one. I was going to steal one of Scott's. I know Scott's going to take this song, but I'm not going to take it right now. I'll take it in the end.
Oh yeah, I know.
You'll take it in the end.
I'm going to pick a different song.
Oh great!
You got us all confused now.
It's not even close. I'm going to take the song "Nirvana" by Juliana Hatfield.
Oh,
that's a good one.
This one counts. Yeah. I'm sure most of you probably heard it, but on her first record, and it's probably my favorite song on the record.
That's a good one. That's cool. That's very, very good. And she's tying it in with Westerberg because she had that band with Paul Westerberg, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the name of that band?
The I Don't Cares.
The I Don't Cares.
I Don't Cares, which is a pretty great band name.
I think it's a great album.
Yeah, it is. It is a really good album. Yeah. Everything ties together. except for Stormtroopers of Death. I don't know.
No.
March of the SOD, a song about their own band. Yeah.
That ties. Okay, so my second choice is Little America from REM off of Reckoning.
Ah.
Wow.
Which,
is that about the band America?
It is, but it's one of those things where they go about it in, you know, I don't know what half the lyrics even are, but every chorus is the biggest wagon, is the something wagon, Jefferson, right. I think we're lost. So it's all right, about right. them in the bus. Right, Jefferson right. Holt is driving and they're looking out right. the window seeing America, you know, another Greenville, another Magic Mark, Jefferson, right. drive it through.
And so does anyone know the words to the early R.E.M. songs?
Dude, I was, you know, like, you can't find the words to Murmur, but I found the words to Little America, and I'm reading them today. And I was like, does this count? I was like, yeah, it counts, because it's
good.
It's Michael Stipe's way of talking. It's Michael Stipe's version of "We're an American Band," is what it is.
Right, right, right. It's really a great song. I think I played that one time in all the years, the 18 years I was playing with R.E.M. I think we played that song maybe once or twice.
So yeah. They would just expect you to have that ready, even though they were never going to play.
They gave me warning because the first three or four tours we did, I mean, over the first like five or, we didn't play any of the old songs, any of those really early songs. And then we finally got back to starting bringing them in every once in a while, you know, and that one showed up. And when we did that record, the Live in Dublin thing where we were, this is not a show, we learned a lot of those songs, but I had to learn them like at the last second, you know, like, we're gonna do this at soundcheck, and I had to learn them, but didn't really matter because Peter playing guitar, so yeah, I could just kind of like follow along. I didn't have to. I wasn't really needed, you know. But I wanted to play them, and I wanted to play them right. So you know, I did. But yeah, and sometimes maybe I'd play organ on them or something like that too. But
right.
But Little America, that's a good one. That's a really good one. They still seem pretty fond of that song too, I think.
It's a good one. It's got that like little bit. Where the chorus turns minor for a couple of lines and then never does it again. It's awesome.
Yeah, by the way, all their old songs are really crazy.
Yeah.
they're not really simple songs, exactly.
You never had to play Wolves Lower, did you?
We played that once or twice, like very, very seldom. But we played Guarding at Night. We played that probably maybe 10 or 15 times in all the years that was in the band, but Wolves probably like maybe twice something. Yeah.
Okay. Ben, what do you got?
Oh, number two for me. Okay. I'm going to go with a song by the Mr. T Experience called The End of the Ramones. Which is about them going to see, I guess, maybe the last Ramones concert.
The End of the Ramones by the Mr. T Experience. I don't know this song, I'm proud to say.
I love Mr. T
Experience. Wait, you got a problem with Mr. T Experience, Scott?
I don't know anything about this. Aren't they one of those like weird...
I love them. They were good pals with Kurt Block from the Fellows and the Fastbacks. They were tight with him, so we got to hang out with them numerous times, and they were really just great Bay Area pop punk band, you know.
They did an amazing cover of one of those Sesame Street songs, Up and Down, you know. I look at you and sing a song about Up and Down. They do a really great sort of like, you know, sort of Green Day-ish pop punk version of that.
So Fellows recorded Sesame Street theme.
Yeah.
On a single. But yeah, the Up and Down is really great. They're a great band. I don't know what's happening with those guys these days.
Yeah, I don't know.
I haven't heard anything from them for a long time. I'll have to ask Kurt. Kurt will know.
Someone's going to write a song about their last concert.
Yes.
End of the Mr. T Experience.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good one.
All right, Scott, back to you for one final round, Scott McCoy.
Okay. I'm going to go with Prisoners of Rock and Roll by Neil Young and Crazy Horse. That's kind of like, it's another one that's like really speaks to me. It's like, you know, about, we're just playing in a garage and we don't want to be good, you know. we don't want the record company man to tell us what to do and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, you know, I love that they distill it all down to, we don't want to be good. You know.
Right.
It's a great rockin' song. It's kind of a period when you don't really hear from Neil that much, but it was on, I think it was on the Life record. But it's a really, really great song, Prisoners of Rock and Roll. That's why we don't want to be good. Yeah.
Is that one of those songs that you're playing when you do those shows? You play Neil Young songs?
I played it once. We played it once at one of the shows. But we haven't played it that often. But I'm thinking we got a show coming up in a couple of weeks. minus five, and I think that should be, we should bring that one back in because it's not too many words to remember.
Right, that's good. That's the important part.
It's a good song. It's a great song. But yeah, I do. I still doing those Neil Young things periodically, and I might be thinking about doing Volume 4 recording sometime soon. But I don't know. I got other things to do too. But anyway,
pretty cool.
Rock and roll. That's a good one.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Gabe, what do you got?
Speaking of rocking, you cannot say this is not the ultimate. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good one. Yeah. I really thought you were going to go for Jukebox Hero, but it's a long way to the top.
No.
But is that really about a specific band?
Which one?
It's a long way to the top.
Yeah. They're riding on the highway, going to the show. Okay. Talking all the byways.
They're not just, they're talking about their own journey. They're not talking about just the cosmic journey of rock and roll.
Yes.
No, they're talking about a specific band's journey.
Okay.
No Tell Motel, make you want to cry. It's poetry, man.
I'll tell you, folks, it's harder than it looks.
That's right.
Fair enough.
Scott, you have an Eddie Vedder song, right?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Scott, is that your pick?
No, I already burned up all my picks.
No, I'm talking to sometimes Scott Lucas.
And that's my pick.
Well, I couldn't pick my own, so I don't think you should be able to pick this out too. Right.
That wouldn't be good. So I'm gonna go for Working for MCA by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Ooh. Oh yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, it's almost like I love my label, but yeah. it's a lot more like he doesn't love the label.
He's right, like, right, exactly.
It's all about like, I'm going to take a look and where all my money goes. And, you know, if you pay me that money, maybe you won't get a scar. Maybe I won't kick your ass. And it's,
it
sounds great. It's a great song and the lyrics are amazing.
Like Mercury Poisoning by Graham Parker and The Rumour.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Their kiss off to Mercury Records, too. Yeah. And do you think that Niccolo, well, I guess he really did love his label when he wrote that song.
Hmm.
But there are probably times when he could sing it later where he could be a little more
it could be sarcastic.
But I think he was talking about Stiff Records probably, and Stiff was pretty great probably.
Yeah.
I think Tweety started singing it after the whole Yankee Hotel Foxtrot thing. So
yeah, they did.
That was
they
certainly did. Sarcastic.
Yeah. Yes.
Different way.
They did a version, but then it came in handy because when Nick Lowe toured with them, they could play it with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Ben, so it falls to me to end this whole thing, and I get to do it by naming one of my all-time favorite songs, for my money, the best song ever written about being in a rock band, and I guess I'm loyal. Some of us probably couldn't call this one out, but I get to. And don't argue with me about this. All the Kids Are Right, Local Eight. Boom, boom.
Oh, nice. That's good.
Fucking masterpiece.
Scott, you can just close your
ears. It's fine. I'm not in the band.
That is great. That is great.
Well, thanks, Ben. Thanks a lot for embarrassing me in front of our guest.
Oh, you're not embarrassed.
Yeah. Minus Five played a show a couple nights ago, and we played The Kids Are All Right. So right. I really appreciate the juxtaposition. You, that's very, very, very good way to do that. Really,
thank
really,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Genius move. Scott and I agree.
Well, it was great to have you here.
Oh man, it was really fun. Really fun. Fun talking to you guys.
Thanks so much for doing it.
Yeah, it's really, really super fun.
And you're going on tour soon, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. We're playing a couple Northwest shows in May, end of May, and then we do like, you know, Chicago and Madison and Cleveland, Philadelphia, New York, and then Solid Sound. We're doing Wilco's Festival.
Do you know where you're gonna play in Chicago?
The Hideout.
Hideout. Oh, great! Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can't be stopped. Keep going.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
See what happens.
sick. I wanna be suctioned. I wanna be